I think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome in. This is episode 5 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. My name is Ben Heisler. I'm glad to have you guys all with us today. Joining me, we got a full edition of the Roundtable. Andrew Buchholz, Joe Lucia, Ken Fang are all here. Gentlemen, it's good to talk to you again, as always. Let's start with some big news over in Bristol. One of the favorites around there, Scott Van Pelt, and his Midnight Eastern edition of SportsCenter. He just got extended last week. And we were talking about this sort of in our pre-show meeting about ESPN and their brand and how, you know, they've had some issues trying to get everybody on board and to try and appeal to everybody. And it feels like Scott Van Pelt's been one of those guys that's really appealed to everybody. When you think about people who are really the most valuable right now to ESPN, Ken, I'll start with you. Where do you think Scott Van Pelt ranks amongst valued members at ESPN right now?
I think at this point, Ben, he is probably, you'd have to consider him now that Chris Berman is basically, for all intents and purposes, basically retired from being the main person on ESPN. He is basically the face of the network right now. Considering that he is doing a lot of stuff, doing the midnight sports centers, and also appearing on the halftimes of Monday Night Football, I consider that he is probably the most valued member of the on-air staff for ESPN. And for them to extend his contract, I think that is just goes hand in hand with what they're thinking. And he's probably going to be the future of the network and probably being there for another 30 years or so.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of who else there could be, there really aren't that many names that pop up. He's generally well-liked across the board. He's not kind of limited to one sport or one area. And he just seems like the guy that's going to kind of carry them on into their next era after this latest round of cuts.
The thing that's really key with Scott Van Pelt is that his show and the Midnight Sports Center, it's not only doing well year over year in the ratings, but as I wrote when we discussed his extension, it's one of the few ESPN programs that's actually made improvements over where they were a couple of years ago, which is remarkable when you consider the subscriber losses, when you consider the lower ratings almost across the board. Scott Van Pelt's Midnight Sports Center has gotten a whole lot of people to tune in, and a lot of people who weren't watching the previous SportsCenter before that. And his approach has some pros and cons. There are some people who don't like it, who want the old school, but there's a lot of younger people in particular who are tuning in and who do like him and who do like some of the different things he brings to the table, whether that's the gambling segments, whether that's the detailed interviews and so on. He's attracted a lot of fans. And I think the other thing that's really helped with him in becoming sort of the face of ESPN is he's opinionated, but he doesn't tend to stir up bad controversies.
Right.
Really, whenever he does anything controversial, it's, say, taking shots at Skip Bayless or taking shots at somebody who other people don't like. And so he doesn't seem anywhere near as polarizing as some of their other personalities, and I think that has really helped him.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
This past weekend, of course.
Elaborate that a little bit, Joe, on what you heard from him and what caused the little bit of controversy.
Well, he went on an SI podcast and had some very harsh things to say about the critics of ESPN and the people that are negative towards the way ESPN is presenting their programming right now. And I think it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because he's kind of feeding into that narrative that, like, you know, nothing is really wrong and everything is fine. It's the whole burying their head in the sand thing. And I think that kind of rubbed some people the wrong way after it seemed like he was kind of balanced and not really toting the company line all that much.
Did you think that it was justified, though? Did you feel like he had a genuine point to what he was saying?
I mean, I think he did. I think ESPN gets criticized too much, but I also think he tried to give his network a bit too much of a free pass.
Ken or Andrew, I guess I'll go back to you guys. With the success that Van Pelt has had with that SportsCenter, with that type of show, with how he's been able to appeal and grow ratings in a time that you said ESPN is losing several subscribers for whatever reasons that they may, is there a formula that they could take for other SportsCenters and say this is a way to be able to increase ratings and find success in the future? Or is this basically, no, you can't do that on that type of basis. Van Pelt is a personality and we're sort of tailoring the SportsCenter to him. And Ken, I'll start with you on that.
I think that it's it works for Van Pelt. They've tried to do some personality-driven programming for the 6 o'clock Sports Center, 6 Eastern, with Michael Smith and Jemele Hill. That hasn't worked as much, but I think this is more tailored to Scott Van Pelt's personality and his strengths, his interviews, his irreverent humor, and also an occasional highlight or two. It all works for him. And I think this is what ESPN is trying to tap into to make SportsCenter more personality-driven. I don't think it's going to work on all ends, but it definitely works for Scott. And it may, and we'll see if it, this thing will work, this formula will work down the road for Mike Greenberg. But right now, I think it's working for the Midnight SportsCenter. It's a perfect wrap-up to the day, especially coming off of big events like Monday Night Football. And, of course, down the road with the college football playoff championship game, it works perfectly. And I think, ESPN has finally tapped into something that they can hang their hat on, a big success, and the reason why they've given Scott Van Pelt a contract extension.
Andrew?
I think they're definitely trying to replicate with other people. I agree with Ken that it hasn't really worked as well in most circumstances, and I don't think that any other sports center has really turned out the way that they as well year over year or over the old one, the way Van Pelt's is. But I don't think that makes the approach entirely wrong. I think they are seeing some progress with some of the other shows, and I think even with some more limited ways, the showing off the personality has helped. I think it's interesting if you watch guys like Neil Everett and Stan Verrett now on the SportsCenter Los Angeles. To me, they're providing more jokes, more of their personalities than they were just a couple of years ago. I think SC6 with Michael and Jamel, that's definitely been controversial, but they're definitely showing their personalities there. I think Van Pelt has the advantage of he's somebody that a lot of people liked before this, and he's doing his personality is something that a lot of people relate to in particular. And I think in particular, he's found so much success with the bad beats, with talking about gambling in a way that hasn't really been approved on ESPN in the past. And I think it's easier for people to really relate to him and jump on board with that. But I think they are finding a little bit of success doing it elsewhere, and they are attracting people who do relate to their other personalities as well.
And a shout out to Stanford Steve. I'm always a fan of whenever shows are bringing their producers on and giving them a little bit more love, but that's purely a personal level for me. One other thing that I have on ESPN that I was curious to get your guys' perspective on is not only did Van Pelt get an extension, but ESPN president John Skipper got extended through 2021 as well. Looking ahead and sort of the challenges that he'll have to face over the next several years, Joe, I'll start with you on this one. What do you think is the biggest challenge for John Skipper and ESPN moving forward over the next several years?
They have to deal with cord cutting and the trends that are coming out of that, because they have taken a big hit this year because of the cord cutting. They lost a lot of money. I don't think that trend is going to stop anytime soon, especially if this net neutrality stuff, if it ends up being repealed like is being discussed right now, I think they'll have another batch of challenges coming out with there. Plus, they also have this political landscape where the social media climate is such a mess that if they continue to just kind of be either heavy-handed or hands-off, they're going to keep rubbing people the wrong way. They have a lot on their plate going forward, and Skipper's in a situation where he needs to actually, like, do something instead of just kind of giving out these little vanilla statements that don't really do a whole lot. And we'll get to this later, but he's actually my sports rookie of the year for how poorly he's handled so many things this year for ESPN.
Well, just to follow up on that really quickly, if he needs to be more proactive in making sure that ESPN doesn't put themselves in a lot of the similar positions that they face this year, are you anticipating that for someone that's made a lot of mistakes, for him to be even more in the public spotlight than he already has been?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to be the public face of ESPN going forward because he is coming out and putting his name on so many of these decisions, from the social media policy to the Barstool ban talk cancellation. It's his name being attached to these decisions, and I think going forward he's going to keep doing that and keep kind of being the one who takes the hits instead of the company. And if he continues making decisions that rub people the wrong way, I think we could see a situation where this contract extension is just going to look worse and worse in hindsight.
Ken, what do you think the biggest challenge for John Skipper will be moving forward?
A lot of it's going to have to do with probably the partnership with the National Football League and that going forward. ESPN paid a lot of money, and granted, it was done before he became the top dog. George Bodenheimer was the one that helped to negotiate that contract. But Skipper has those waters to deal with, to wade through. The contract ends, I believe, after the 2021 season.
Yes.
And ESPN has not had a great schedule for Monday Night Football. They thought they were going to get the schedule that NBC had, but they didn't get that. So they also not in the Super Bowl rotation. I don't expect them to be in the next one either. So I think that's going to be a big challenge for him. As Joe mentioned, the net neutrality and the streaming channel that they were putting a lot of eggs in their basket, and if net neutrality is repealed, ESPN may be in a lot of trouble in trying to get that going forward. So cord cutting, the NFL, I think those are two big issues that John Skipper has to deal with, and also going forward, trying to renew some of the rights too, because they're going to have to deal with less money. ESPN got a lot of rights in 2013 and 2014 and in the 2015 because they had a lot of money. They're not that cash cow that they were for as they were in the past. So they're going to have to be able to see where they're going to be able to go going forward in negotiating these contracts and getting sports rights.
What about for you, Andrew? What do you anticipate as the largest problem ahead and the largest issue for John Skipper moving forward?
Yeah, I think you guys hit on a bunch of them, but I think the biggest problem is really on the corporate side, and it's because ESPN is such a critical part of Disney and such a really the key part of Disney's media networks at this point. And any pressure on Disney, a lot of that is coming from downturns in the media networks and from downturns at ESPN. If you listen to their regular earnings conference calls, a lot of the time it's about, well, we've got all these, we've lost revenue at ESPN, we've lost subscribers at ESPN. It's fine, we've got a plan to fix it, but it keeps happening. And so I think the OTT service is really going to be huge there, and it's really going to be interesting to see how that launch is received and if it starts really turning around the financials in the way that they hope it will. And I think part of that also ties in to some of what we were talking about with the social media, with the controversies. I think John Skipper has to realize that ESPN is not in a place where they can be all things to all people anymore. That's something that's really shown up again and again with these controversies they've wound up in. There are people who are going to like certain parts of ESPN, whether that's live games, whether that's a particular show like Scott Van Pelt's or SC6, and who are not going to like other things the company does. There are people who want the opinionated personalities and want those opinionated personalities to be able to speak their mind on Twitter. And there are people who absolutely hate that. And to me, the Barstool Van Talk thing in particular shows that they try to keep taking this middle road and making everyone mad in the process. If you're determined to go one way or the other on that, either you don't do the show in the first place or you stick with it even after the criticism. But instead, they found a way to alienate both sides. So I think that's going to be a big challenge for Skipper, really figuring out what ESPN is, what parts of it can appeal to what people, and really just establishing a sort of a positive brand identity for it in the wake of all the criticism out there. The other thing that he's going to have to deal with, though, on the corporate side, is that there's a lot of possible challengers for them and dangerous challengers for them from how other things are playing out. Disney tried to get Fox's non-news and non-sports assets. It doesn't look like that's going to work out now. Now that might wind up over at Comcast, which makes them even more formidable, adds to their NBC assets. The AT&T Time Warner thing, that could still go ahead. That makes Turner all of a sudden a lot more powerful. And so it's not just the challenges that they're facing from cord cutting and from changing revenue streams and from political controversies and so on. Disney and ESPN are also facing the challenge of all these other media companies that may be adding scale and may be more some competitors than they have been.
Hey, Joe, you brought up something earlier that I want to go back to, and that was the idea of how net neutrality could play a role in a lot of these networks moving forward. I guess if you can you sort of give a basic detail on sort of what the major discussion is with regards to net neutrality and how it relates towards the sports media landscape and sort of what role you think it might play moving forward?
Sure. To put it in very, very simple terms, essentially, if the net neutrality rules are repealed, which all intents and purposes they will be sometime this week, ISPs can essentially charge customers more money to access certain sites. Say, if your ISP is Comcast, they can make you pay an extra $5 a month to access ESPN, Fox Sports, et cetera, et cetera. Or they can slow those sites down to a level where it's really just interminable for you to watch them, and you have to pay them money to kind of speed them up to another level. And how this could affect ESPN is if they roll out this new streaming service they're talking about, the ESPN Plus, along with the Watch ESPN that they have right now. If they do that, combined with the net neutrality rules getting flipped, we'd be in a situation where Comcast and Cox and Verizon and all of these other major cable providers can essentially say to customers, look, you have to pay us X amount of dollars if you want to stream ESPN programming on top of what the customers would be paying the ESPN to have access to the ESPN Plus or the ESPN on their cable package, which really creates a situation where customers are forced to pay both the provider and the network for the same service, which could lead to a situation where people just throw their hands up, give up, and don't pay for either, which would really be bad for ESPN because they're not getting it from either side.
Right. That's the fascinating part about this for me, is that we always talk about how television would probably, and cable providers would likely be in a better position moving forward if they said, okay, like, we'll offer more a la carte options and provide you more choices. But for internet access and for net neutrality purposes, it doesn't seem to work on that same ground, that most people want to be able to have the complete and total freedom when it comes to where you go online, and just say, all right, I'm willing to just sort of go all in, because online streaming can sort of take you in all sorts of different directions. Is there anybody besides the cable and the internet providers that would be in favor of this, Ken?
You know, I would have to say that, yeah, absolutely. The cable and the networks would absolutely love this. Cable and satellite providers love this, because then they get to control everything. And in that case, they can just, and as Joe did a great explanation on how they can slow and throttle the speed of your internet and throttle Netflix and throttle the Hulus and especially ESPN. So this is something that a lot of people have been against. The Obama administration put the net neutrality rules in, and now apparently the FCC is going to revoke them. And if that happens, and it probably is going to happen, new services, new over-the-top services, who want to be independent, like the WWE Network and ESPN, are going to be greatly affected by this. And it's something that they want to be able to go into and have a clean slate. But at this point, it's tough for them, it's tough sledding for them, especially if the Comcast, if the Coxes, if the Verizons, if all these cable companies who also provide internet services just decide to throttle and slow down internet speed, that affects a lot of customers. And to be able to say, look, for them to be able to control that, that's going to be very hard for the consumer going forward.
Andrew, would you anticipate a lot of these, not the cable and internet providers per se, but the cable companies and the video streamers, the Netflix, the Hulus of the world, the different other sports media providers, do you anticipate that they would side with the public here and really fight moving forward, especially if there is a continued trend towards more and more digital services? Do you anticipate them putting up a fight as well?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, something that's interesting on this front is Netflix, which has historically been one of the hardest companies out there fighting hardest for phone net neutrality. And their CEO said this summer that it's no longer the company's top priority to do that because they've hit a scale, they've reached a point where they're still probably going to be fine. They're going to wind up still getting decent deals because everybody wants Netflix. I think so. The challenge is that ESPN is big enough that they may be able to pull off some of those as well. We may see some other companies pull those off as well. But even in those cases, you're not going to see those deals across the board. You're going to see them with maybe a couple of internet providers. You're going to see some gaps in it. And you may even wind up seeing things like cable carriage negotiations, where all of a sudden you wind up with escalations on both sides and access to certain things being pulled or costing extra or being throttled down. And so, yeah, I mean, on some level, the content providers are going to fight against this, but some of them aren't. And that's where the scale and the acquisitions become important, because say all of a sudden, maybe this works out really well for NBC now that their content gets more featured by Comcast. Maybe it works out really well for Turner if the AT&T deal goes through and all of a sudden Turner content starts getting featured everywhere. So it's certainly not going to be an across the board pushback from content creators. There's going to be some of it, but who knows if that's going to be enough, especially considering that the government and the FCC at this point seem very much in favor of overthrowing these net neutrality rules.
Well, I mean, it's definitely something that we're going to be discussing for a long time, both whether or not this passes through either this week or the following, and it'll impact the landscape of sports media moving forward, especially as we advance more towards the technological side and the streaming side. So definitely something for us to keep an eye on. I wanted to make sure we covered it with especially this story starting to gain more and more traction this week. Let's talk about some of the things that we're going to be getting into this upcoming weekend. This is an intriguing thing that I realized this week, in that Ohio State and Michigan, and it's a big rivalry weekend for college football, it will air on Fox for the first time. It's always been sort of an ABC staple, and it's likely to stay on Fox moving forward with their deal with the Big Ten. Do you guys have anything in mind as sort of an event or sport that you've always associated with one network that maybe you miss being on that network, or something that has always stood out, like baseball, the World Series always has to be on Fox, or anything along those lines where you just feel like it has to stay with that one channel, with that one network? This is sort of what you're used to. Andrew, I'll start with you on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's one where I feel it has to be that because I recognize the realities of the sports media landscape, but I think I've definitely seen some over the years that have been disappointing. One for me was the various shifts with Monday Night Football and seeing that move to cable, and it being, and in particular at the start, it being a really different presentation on ESPN and one that I didn't feel was up there with what they had done before. Another thing that we often see on this front is when it comes to, say, the Stanley Cup Finals, and you get a couple of of important games pushed over to NBCSN rather than NBC. I get why they do it. It's a perfectly reasonable business move to do it, but it's hard for fans of the sport, and it's hard for people who really want the sport to get the biggest ratings and the biggest audiences possible. So I think it's something we will see more of, it's especially as these rights become more and more expensive, but it is definitely something that can have a negative impact for fans.
How about you, Joe?
I've been trying to think about something that I just associate with a certain network, and I guess for me, I'm not a huge golf guy, but it seems like the Masters and CBS to me just kind of go hand in hand. I always think of those two together, and it would be really weird to me if I saw the phrase, like, the Masters on NBC. It just would not feel right, and because they have this weird contract situation where they renew it every year, I don't know if it would end up going to another network, but I would just feel very strange to see the Masters airing their last day coverage on a network other than CBS.
It's a good one. What about you, Ken?
I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the Masters too, but I think more in line what we've seen over the last few years is when Turner got into the Final Four,
yeah,
and started broadcasting that. I mean, for a while it was nice to see that Turner and the final at least would be on CBS and Turner would take the Final Four. But now in the new arrangement that has Turner and CBS alternating each year, I just feel that it just seems, even though CBS is still producing the coverage, it just seems strange to see the whole Final Four and the final on CBS. I'd rather see it on CBS, but I know why they do it. I know why CBS went to Turner to partner. It was a whole economics thing. I still would prefer at least seeing, if they're going to split up, at least the Final Four on Turner and the final on CBS, but that's just me.
I don't know about you guys. I know it's been several years, but I still miss the NBA on NBC. ABC has obviously been partners with them for a long time, but I miss how big the NBA Finals used to feel when the coverage was on NBC. And I don't know if you guys sort of feel the same way or not, or whether or not ABC has felt the same, but I miss that type of feeling, and maybe that's just me growing up as a 90s Bulls fan, but that's something that I'd love to see return. I just don't know for the foreseeable future if that's going to be the case. I doubt it.
I think the one that we didn't mention too, because it hasn't actually happened yet, but I feel we may see a lot of people nostalgic for ESPN's World Cup coverage if Fox is doesn't go so well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think especially once the summer hits and the games kick off, I think that's going to be a major conversation on social media. If fans of the World Cup are not happy with the presentation, I better believe that's going to be something that comes up for a lot of different conversations. All right, Joe mentioned this in the final, or not in the final, but in the earlier part of the show. He named, who did you name as your sports media turkey of the year? It was John Skipper, right?
John Skipper, yeah, that was my pick.
Okay, so I'm going to throw it back over to Ken as we wrap up the roundtable edition before we hear from Dominique Foxworth from The Undefeated, and also our game to give our listeners an opportunity to win $50 to Amazon courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. Ken, give me your sports media turkey of 2017. Who is it for you?
For me, hands down, it was Jamie Horowitz, formerly of Fox Sports. Even if he hadn't been fired, I would have given it to him just because he pivoted FoxSports.com from a news gathering operation and one that had a very good fan base to video and basically wiping that audience out. So after a week after we reported on Awful Announcing about the whole idea of Fox pivoting to video, he got fired over something unrelated amid sexual harassment allegations. So my sports turkey has to be Jamie Horowitz. He's been fired from NBC, from the Today Show. He's been fired from Fox. And now with these sexual harassment allegations, I'm not sure he'd be able to find another job in television, although stranger things have happened. But Jamie Horowitz is my sports turkey of 2017.
Andrew, I know you're up in Canada, I believe, correct? So even though it may not be the Canadian Thanksgiving, I still need a sports media turkey from you.
No, I'm in California, but I am Canadian, and so I get to celebrate both Thanksgivings.
There you go. All right, very, very good. All right, who's your sports media turkey for 2017?
Well, I've been mulling this one for a couple of days, and the first thought, there have been a lot of good candidates. My first thought was going with Phil Mushnick from the New York Post, who just seems to get continually worse and worse. I'm actually going to go in a little bit of a different direction. And my sports media turkey of the year is a group award. And it is to every single producer who has ever booked LeVar Ball on it. LeVar Ball is a creation of the media. He's a guy that received way too much attention time and time again, especially on Fox Sports 1, but also on ESPN. And he's a guy who they put on just because it gets attention. It's because it creates outlandish things and gets incredible headlines. And whoever had the bright idea of putting him on CNN for 23 minutes this week is in on this award as well. So my turkey is a collective one to everyone who ever decides to book LeVar Ball.
Nothing I can say better other than this.
You are a hater.
It's the beauty of having the soundboard nearby. I couldn't think of anybody, so I'm just going to go ahead and call Jerry Jones my sports media turkey of the year, mostly because of his turkey neck that's sort of been growing out and the fact that he's now trying to fight Roger Goodell in a battle that I don't think he's going to be able to win if it's between Goodell and the other owners in the National Football League. But Andrew Buchholz, Joe Lucia, Ken Fang, always, gentlemen, I appreciate your time. Read their great work over at awfulannouncing.com. Follow them on Twitter as well. Coming up on the other side, a chance for you guys to win $50 to Amazon.com just by playing our game. And also former NFL cornerback, president of the NFLPA. He's a Harvard Business School graduate and currently with the undefeated at ESPN. Dominique Foxworth is our featured guest of the day. Plenty more to come. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by Clip It.
You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by our good friends over at Clip It. You can download the Clip It app today on iOS and on Android. And if you're familiar with the podcast, you know this is the opportunity to make our contestants rich. And by rich, I mean an opportunity to win $50 to Amazon, courtesy of the good people over at Clip It. And today's guest is Chris from Farmington, Connecticut. How are you, Chris?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being our contestant. You properly identified this week's guest on Twitter. It is Dominique Foxworth of ESPN's Undefeated. Excited to hear from him in just a few short minutes here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. But, Chris, here is how the game will work. We have two clips from the good people over at Clip It. I will play them both for you. If you identify both of them right, that means you will get $50 to Amazon.com. You get just one. It's 25. And if you get none, well, then you have to go back home and face the music and tell your family that I did not get $50 to Amazon that I could have used for the holidays, and I'll have to do better for next time. So no pressure, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, let's start it off. This first clip is from this SEC announcer who might wish that he could have his line possibly come back. Take a listen.
Throw over the middle of Geist, trying to change directions, does get the first down.
I mean, Miles Brennan is more of a pure passer. There's no doubt about it. Etling took a big hit on the last series. Remember? I wonder if he's a little bit stunned.
You know what? I was a little bit stunned when I heard this announcer say that. Chris in Farmington, which announcer said a line that maybe he wishes he could take back?
Is it Gary Danielson?
It is Gary Danielson. Nicely done. Of course, with Brad Nessler on the call. And the part that we cut out of this was there was about 10 to 15 seconds of dead air right afterwards. So certainly I know that Brad Nessler probably heard it, but maybe Gary Danielson, if he hears it again, he might reconsider his phrasing. All right, so $25 to Amazon is in your pocket. We cannot take that away. But now you have an opportunity to win another 25 to get you up to 50. This clip from Clip It is from a very fun-loving announcer, a man that I've always enjoyed for a long time, but this fun-loving guy was a little bit upset at some people from his alma mater. Take a listen.
The noble purpose here has been stained. Our host, Alibaba China, the people, They have been better than perfect in everything. They've done everything right to make this all work. Now, members of our family have displayed an appalling lack of honor, lack of respect, lack of decency by doing something in someone else's home that they would never do in their own. And I want to apologize right now on behalf of the human race for this travesty.
So there you have it. If this gentleman, Chris, can apologize on behalf of the human race, then we need to be accepting of his apology. Who was the man that apologized on behalf of the human race?
It's got to be Bill Walton.
It sure is, Bill Walton. Nicely done. Chris, from Farmington, Connecticut, you are going home today with $50 to Amazon.com. Great opportunity to start loading up for the holidays. Thank you so much for playing and for joining us on the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Awesome. This is a lot of fun.
So there you have it. Chris from Farmington, Connecticut was our winner this week. Who knows, maybe in a few weeks you will have the opportunity to win. But we all win coming up next when Dominic Foxworth of The Undefeated from ESPN joins us. Had a fantastic conversation that you are not going to want to miss. Don't go anywhere. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by Clip It.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by our friends over at Clip It, the number one way to share your favorite movie clips, television clips, sports clips, whatever clips you decide to share with your friends and family and anyone else that you'd like to be able to pass things along to. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and on Android. Very thankful to have our next guest join us. Had a conversation with former Denver Bronco, Atlanta Falcon, Baltimore Raven, Dominique Foxworth, who you can now read over at The Undefeated, part of ESPN. You can hear on ESPN Radio as well. He was also the former NFLPA president, a Harvard Business School graduate, someone that I've really wanted to talk to since we decided to have this podcast, somebody who I find to be fascinating and a terrific interview, and he certainly was. And we began our conversation by asking him, you know, you've played professional football and you've gone to Harvard Business School and you were the president of the NFLPA and now you're a journalist for ESPN. What did you envision doing as a career when you were a kid?
Well, I mean, I think like a lot of little boys in particular, I thought I was going to be a professional athlete. And I remember having this conversation. My dad was in the military, so we moved around a little bit when I was young, and I remember being, when we were in Indianapolis, I was in the first grade. I talked to my dad and said that I was going to be a professional football player when I grew up, and he, at the time, I thought that he just like really believed in me, but I figured out later that, I mean, I'm sure he did believe in me, but I think he was just using it as an opportunity to teach me about goal setting, because he said, important thing to do when you're setting goals is to kind of set all these little goals in between the big goal to help you get there, and do something every single day to get you closer to that goal, whether it's big or small. And I remember very clearly that I did sit-ups and push-ups that night until I threw up. And then my dad had a conversation with me about moderation.
So you had the conversation about goals, and then all of a sudden it was like, all right, well, you can try and get to those goals. You just need to find the proper approach to getting there.
Yeah, no, it was, like I said, I realized that many years later that it was a lesson that probably would have served me well no matter what career I went to, but I just thought it was, like, my dad was all in on this football thing, and he certainly did support me. Him and my mom both supported me throughout my early life, giving me all the opportunities I needed. And, I mean, I worked hard and played well, but, I mean, it's a lot of luck, as I'm sure you've been around sports long enough to know that there's a lot of luck that goes into making it to reaching your final goal, and I'm happy that it worked out for me. But I certainly did not have Harvard Business School in my mind afterwards, or journalist, so I just kind of just go where my curiosity takes me, and I'm fortunate enough to have played long enough to be in a situation where I can kind of do that professionally, because I'm fairly stable financially.
Do you distinctly remember maybe a point or a moment in time when you were working towards that goal of being a professional football player that, I guess, you came to a realization that you knew you were good enough to not just play football at a high level like at the University of Maryland, but to play at the highest levels of the NFL? Was there one point in your career growing up where you sort of recognized a moment that you could do something that the majority of the kids around you just simply couldn't do?
Well, I mean, it probably fits in with being a cornerback and kind of cocky, maybe on arrogant. But I think no, there wasn't really that moment because I kind of always believed that that I was going to be there. I think there were a couple moments where I questioned myself. I think those stand out in my mind, but I think 75% of the time I was like, oh yeah, obviously I want to go to the NFL. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get there, and I'm good enough to get there. But I do remember being in middle school, and like in elementary school, you're fastest kid in elementary school. That's cool. I got to middle school, and I remember I was not the fastest kid in my middle school, and I was like, huh, this is interesting. and that's like something that stands out in my mind where I was like, oh, maybe I'm not as good as I think I'm going to be. And the same sort of thing happened on a bigger scale when I graduated from high school early and started. I think Philip Rivers was kind of the first player to do the second half of his senior year at college, and I came up the year after him, so I did the same sort of thing, graduated early, and then second half of my senior year, I was taking classes and doing spring ball with the team, and I was terrible at both school and football, and that was kind of the second time when I was like, oh, maybe this won't work out. Let me make sure I get this degree because I'm not as good as the rest of these guys. But those are kind of the only times where I remember thinking that I wasn't going to go, which, like I said, maybe I'm just arrogant, but most of the other time I was like, yeah, obviously I'm going to the NFL. I realize how stupid that sounds now, but I was young and naive.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's always going to be sort of inevitable pockets in people's lives where they're trying to figure out what they want to do and something gets in the way and you find a way to overcome it. I mean, people go through college and they sort of rediscover things about themselves that maybe they didn't notice before, but like, there were the obstacles in the way and you sort of got around them.
Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly look back on that time with a lot of pride now. I still have the first college ID that I had because I started school, and because it was mid-semester or mid-year, the second semester, I was they didn't have like a streamlined admissions process necessarily. Yeah. So I had taken classes for about a week and a half before I got my photo taken for my ID. And I was beat down from working out and going to class and doing spring ball. And I still have that ID picture where I looked like I just finished crying. Like it was the most dejected, non-smiling little kid that you could ever have. So I still have that ID somewhere in my office at home.
And the good news is that
I
you can
upon it every now and then.
The good news, yeah,
it gives me a good laugh.
You could probably still use that ID to go to University of Maryland games, sneak in with the student section for free if you wanted to.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think they might be able to tell because I have a smile on my face now. It doesn't look like the same person. I'll have to send you or tweet out or something a picture of it because I look it looks terrible.
Please do. Please do. Was there anybody when you were in the process of trying to develop your game that you remember watching distinctly in the NFL? Was there a corner that you sort of tailored your game after? And eventually, you know, a lot of guys say like, oh, I wanted to be, you know, Deion Sanders, or I wanted to be so-and-so. And then they realize that, no, I kind of just have to be me. Who was that guy initially, and when did you sort of come to your own and sort of realize like what your skill sets best represented about you?
Yeah, I wasn't a cornerback until I got to college. So I remember being a big Barry Sanders fan. I ended up playing a lot of safety and running back and a little bit of quarterback in high school. And I was recruited as an athlete. Then I got there and decided I wanted to play cornerback because I thought that was a tough position to play, which meant that if I could play well there, then I could obviously end up in NFL. I feel like the path there would have been easier for me than going receiver or something, or trying to be a 150-pound running back, which is what I was at the time. That would not have worked out. And being in Maryland in the D.C. area, being close to Washington, Champ Bailey was kind of the best corner in the league, and I was fortunate enough. He got traded out to Denver, and when I was drafted, I ended up out there with him, and we became really good friends, and he became like a mentor to me, obviously, and we still keep in touch to this day.
So you get to the NFL, as you mentioned, you're a third-round pick by the Broncos. Do you remember your first welcome to the NFL rookie moment?
Yeah, actually, I do. It was very early on. So Jerry Rice had just signed with Denver, and he was another big player from my childhood. My brother play receiver when we was young. He really loved Jerry Rice, and we always liked watching him. I remember quite clearly lining up across from Jerry Rice in one-on-one drills. And I mean, it wasn't Jerry Rice in his prime, obviously, but I covered him well, and I broke up the pass, and I was at home. Wow. It just kind of hit me, like, this NFL, that was Jerry Rice. I'm here, and it felt good. So I guess my welcome to the NFL moment was kind of more of a positive one. And my whole rookie season actually went surprisingly well. I ended up starting a bunch of games and playing well. So I don't really have the same experience that I had in college where I got there and I was like, oh, maybe I don't belong here. I didn't have that experience in the NFL. I got there and I played well right away, and I felt comfortable and confident.
And that's pretty remarkable early on. Like, I remember thinking, and again, this is just sort of the idiot in me, is that I remember D. Milner got picked, and this is a corner that I thought was just had stud written all over him, and a guy that was in a really good system at Alabama, and he comes and the whole time, his first few seasons in the NFL, he just looks so bewildered and lost, and you get to the point where this is somebody that came in thinking the strength of his was sort of being able to figure out a pro system, and he just looked completely lost. And for you to be able to go right in and say, okay, no, I know where I'm supposed to be. I know my assignments. I know the system well enough to be able to produce right away. That must have been a huge confidence builder for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's I think I also entered the league kind of with a chip on the shoulder. While I probably did deserve to be a third-round pick, I didn't think I did. I thought that I should have been, like, a first-round pick. So I showed up kind of angry, which that might be the difference between coming to college and went to NFL. When I got to college, I kind of showed up like, yeah, I was one of the highest rated recruits that year. And I was like, I belong here. I'm supposed to be good. And I got to the NFL. I was like, hey, they don't think I'm any good. And I'm sure there's more to it than that. And having the support of teammates and champ, having Champ there to help me through all that stuff. But I certainly showed up with something to prove in a different way than I did showing up to college.
I'm talking to Dominique Foxworth here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. You can read his work over on The Undefeated. You can hear him on ESPN Radio as well. So when you get drafted in 2015, you have success right away, and then 2007 comes by, and then you're selected as the team player representative for the NFLPA. I'm curious to know how that process works. Does the team all vote and say, hey, we want Dominique to be our guy, or is it like a school council presentation? Do you go and make a presentation to your team saying that you want to be the guy? How does that process work for you to end up representing your team at the NFLPA?
Yeah, so the PA comes and they do elections, and somebody on the team has to nominate you, and a few people get nominated, and then you vote. That's how the process should work. But in Denver, Rod Smith was the veteran receiver who everyone kind of trusted, and he was the team rep. And there's normally one rep and one alternate. And he pulled me aside and said, you're going to be the alternate. I mean, there was no questions asked. And then he went to the meeting, and after he was nominated and elected, he nominated me. And people knew better, I guess, than to go against what Rod thought was best. So there was no need for election. I stepped right in and then got involved with the Players Association and really appreciated an opportunity to use kind of a different part of my intellect, because football requires a great deal of mental strength, but it's different than what the kind of long-term and strategic thinking that's required for being a player rep and the leadership.
I know that Rod Smith said that it was the right choice. Did you think it was the right choice initially? Were you prepared for that type of role? Was that something that you wanted?
I mean, I guess it felt like respect, so I appreciated it. And I don't think at the time I was intimidated by how much work it was, because I mean, I was an alternate. Like Rod, I felt like Rod could do the work, he could handle it, and I could kind of tag along and learn and do what I could on the side. But once I got to the meeting, because I saw what was happening, I really was excited by the opportunity and like became part of the executive committee very quickly, which was, I don't know, it was probably one of the younger members to do that. So, I mean, I appreciate Rod for giving me the opportunity, and I appreciate the other reps for believing in me and electing me to that position.
I apologize if this question sounds a little bit cliche, but I am naturally curious to sort of find out what these meetings are like. Was there a very eye-opening moment for you during these initial meetings and sort of the ongoing battle between the owners and the NFLPA? Because you have, you know, your vision of it early on when it first comes out, and you're starting off as the alternate, and then you get fully more invested. Eventually, you become the president of the NFLPA, which we'll get to in a little bit. But what sort of opened your eyes into what these types of battles between the owners and the Players Association is like?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone, all kids growing up, grow up wanting, not all kids, but many kids grow up and want to be in the NFL, but you don't realize that the NFLPA is really what you want to be a part of, because that's the reason why you have the work rules and access to free agency and, like, as many legal battles and strikes and lockouts endured by many players to give you that opportunity. It wasn't something that was given to you, and I think we all, as fans, at least look at the game and think of it as, like, maybe things have changed recently, but when I was a kid, it's like you look at it and you say, this is NFL, this is all happy and fun and everyone works together, but
right.
There is a battle going on behind closed doors. And I mean, you apologize for asking a cliche question, so I guess I should apologize for giving you a cliche answer, but they don't get to be billionaires by being benevolent.
So right.
Everything that you want, like, no matter how big or small, it's going to require some sort of sacrifice and require a fight. And you'd learn that very early on from, you hear it from players, but you also learn it quickly when you're involved in players' negotiations and meetings and with the league or just with ourselves.
What do you think the biggest misconception about these meetings and maybe the NFLPA is in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people generally kind of misunderstand what the CBA negotiations are like. And where, or not just CBA negotiations, I think people generally misunderstand what negotiations are. And they think that it's about going in the room and two guys or a couple of guys face off and try to outwit each other
right.
with, like, crafty maneuvers and tricky words. But, I mean, it comes down to creating leverage, which doesn't come from one individual being able to think of some new tactic or try to play hardball or, like, all these things that when you see negotiations on TV, you're like, oh, yeah, if I can keep a good poker face, then I'll win this negotiation. Like, that stuff is fanciful. Like, it's about creating leverage and power, and you can do that through several different means. So I think that's the most interesting part is that's probably the most misunderstood part, is like what actually goes into CBA negotiations, and frankly how the players have always been and still remain at, like, quite a dramatic disadvantage when attempting to negotiate against the owners.
Well, let's dive a little bit further into that. Obviously, you're talking about billionaire owners and only 30 of them versus, you know, thousands of players that are being represented by the NFLPA. So, yeah, naturally, you're going to have the guys that have a little bit more leverage be able to play that card. I remember Eric Winston, who's the current NFLPA president, said in an interview that, you know, players should be ready to anticipate a possible lockout when the next CBA is up. Do you think that's something realistic that the NFL could really say, if we need to hold that on the owners this time, that that's our best chance of getting what we need to be successful? Do you think that's a realistic possibility?
I do. I mean, I think it's a realistic possibility. I mean, you're talking about the players potentially going on strike or the owners locking them out. I think the owners, it's always a possibility that the owners could lock players out. But I do think that with proper preparation, the players could withstand a lockout or even embark on a strike themselves. So it's not ideal. Strikes have not ended in success. The only kind of really, for the NFL at least, the only really successful tactics that the NFLPA has used have been legal means and decertification. Those sort of tactics work pretty well. But I think that, I mean, you've seen this year and the last couple of years in the Anthem demonstrations where I know that it's kind of a bit of a stretch to connect these two, but it's about kind of principles and resilience. And if guys have believe strongly in something, I think that they are willing to sacrifice to get there. I think the challenging thing with CBA negotiations is there's no big thing. Once we've already gotten free agency and the guys are making a lot of money, if there's a percentage point here or there off, it's not making a major impact on a player, so they don't necessarily feel that strongly about enduring a strike. So I think they're capable, but I think oftentimes the incentive, and I don't hold it against them, I think that it's probably the logical decision, because if a player is under contract and you remove 1% or add 1% to the revenue that they're going to gain, what it means to their contract is minor in comparison to what they would lose for having to have to miss a game or four games or a season worth of games. So I think that's part of the thing that people misunderstood. It's like, you just want to go on strike. If you want things, you can get it. But there's a calculus that it doesn't seem to make sense, especially given the fact that the average career is only 3.5 seasons.
Yeah, that's a really important part as we're talking to Dominic Foxworth here of The Undefeated on the Awful Announcing podcast. I guess one more on this for me. If you were advising Eric Winston and advising the NFLPA as they head into their next negotiation, I think what a lot of fans typically hear is that players are upset with Thursday night games. They don't feel like it gives their body a proper opportunity to recover. And you can certainly make the argument that the NFL in general, playing football doesn't necessarily give your body a chance to recover. What do you think will be the most important chip on the negotiating table between the players and the owners with regards to the next CBA?
I don't know. I think that's a tough question. I mean, football is unique, is a unique game because I think one of the things that's most unique about football, because it, I think it's unique in many ways, but one of the things that's most unique is like how dangerous it is. So I feel like health and safety was at the forefront for us during the last negotiation.
Sure.
And given the fact that we still don't fully understand the impact of concussions and CTE on brain health, I think that still should be at the forefront of a player's mind. But I mean, there's nothing in a deal that's perfect, from player discipline to even the existence of the salary cap in a draft. Like, those things don't fly in other workplaces. And I know it feels like crazy to imagine a world in NFL where a salary cap doesn't exist, but I feel like that getting closer to a normal workplace would be something that I would put near the top of the list, but very far-fetched and difficult to achieve.
No, I like that idea a lot, Kev. Give the players the proper opportunity to earn what they deserve. And baseball, while not necessarily on a national level, has continued to develop ratings, but on a local level, I mean, the television ratings are through the roof, and there's plenty of money coming in. So I think the argument is justified. It's just a question of whether or not the owners are willing to go through with it, which sort of remains another possibility.
I mean, one of the things that I've written about on The Undefeated, and I talk about a lot, is I'm not sure that, particularly for other sports, but football is included, but I'm not sure that having a union is beneficial to the players at this point anymore. Like, I think that you could get away with a trade association, which would leave the league and the owners open to antitrust litigation, which would force them, because the only reason why things like the draft and the salary cap and all these other work rules and player discipline, the only reason why those exist is because we agree to collective bargaining agreement with the CBA. If you remove that, you can still, you then open them up like the same way you can't, like a group of companies can't organize to suppress the wages of any other workers.
Right.
And that's the same thing that's happening in football. So I don't know. It's a bit of a far-fetched idea, but I think that all the things that the trade association could provide the players are sufficient, and maybe that we're at a point now where most sports would be better off without the advantages, I guess, that come from being a union.
You mentioned something about player safety that I wanted to make sure I asked you about, because I was reading an article about you in the Baltimore Sun. I think it came out maybe January of this year. And you were talking about how you first saw concussion and how it made you question so much about your time playing football, what could potentially be coming, your future, your the health of yourself and for players around you. When you were playing, was there any sort of collective mindset for players regarding future health, sort of like a, what am I doing? Or what I'm doing is potentially putting myself at risk long term. Was there any thought of that, at least when you were playing?
Yeah. I mean, it started the CTE and concussion information started to come to light during my career. I think players started to understand it and think about it more. But and the chronic pain, like separate from the brain and your joints and muscles and bones, like that's something that we are all always aware of. But the stuff that impacts your brain is obviously much more frightening. And it was starting to come to light, whereas, I mean, you know, that prior to that, people just thought that like a concussion was kind of a minor thing. You kind of shake it off. We would occasionally like celebrate those knockout hits, and even amongst us on the team, we'd laugh at each other.
The jacked up movement, right?
And that's all changed now.
It's remarkable too, and I've talked about this before, but I sort of subscribe to the Malcolm Gladwell theory that football over time is more information about subconcussive head injuries and more information about brain injuries as it starts to come out, and more parents say, I'm just simply not going to risk my child's brain for this sport, that football could, at least from the professional level, could sort of become the way that maybe in some senses the military has looked at it, sort of as an ends to justify the means. So in a certain sense, maybe that's already begun, but where do you see the future of football going? Is it always going to exist professionally, even if, you know, more education-based programs try to distance themselves? Because I would imagine that if more of these studies come out, and I saw that Boston University was able, I believe, to test the first site of CTE amongst living patients, I can't imagine that more education programs in schools would try and keep football around, knowing that the litigation that could come from it could be systemic.
Yeah, no, I think that is definitely a big fear for the league. But as long as there's money to be made, I think the game will still happen. We still have boxing and mixed martial arts, which are like boxing. The point of boxing is to knock someone unconscious. So
right.
I think if there is money to be made, that means that the athletes will put themselves at risk. And if there is money to be made, the league will still exist. But I think the point that you make about schools, high schools and colleges, I think is a good one. I think that's where we'll see the impact. And that might have long-term impact. And I don't necessarily think that it's the long-term impact is on players making it to the league or the talent level of players dropping. I think it's just more on, like we mentioned, football is a unique game. And I remember when I first got to business school, some of the international students would want me to explain football to them. And that kind of really made it clear to me how unlike any other game it is, how odd it is. And why that matters is I think a lot of people learn about football from playing it or having relatives that play it when they're kids. And that's how you kind of become a fan of it, because the rules, it's not like basketball, soccer, lacrosse, hockey, like all those are kind of the same game. Like it's a continuous game, go up and down, and you try to get a ball into or a puck or something into a goal of some sort. Football's not like any of those games. And I think it does require some learning process, requires growing up around it. If people aren't growing up around it, it might impact their fans or the level of fans and the level of commitment from fans going forward.
That's what I find fascinating too about football, and you know, we're talking to Dominic Foxworth from The Undefeated here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. Football is a game about change and adaptation and adjusting to scheme. And so I look at all these different coaches, both sort of the younger whiz kids, sort of the Kyle Shanahan type of generation, to sort of the older Bill Belichick guys. And it's still about the same thing. It's adjusting on the fly and being able to make the proper adjustments to be successful. And I see that in the game plan. And I see that these coaches are fully capable of it. And then I think sort of from the outside looking in that society is changing, and there needs to be a little bit more acceptance and tolerance. And there's so many times where I just question that these guys who professionally adjust as part of their job have such an inability for, say, something like the Colin Kaepernick situation, to be able to adjust their way of thinking. Oh, no, it's going to be a distraction, and you know, we don't want the extra media attention. We don't want to talk about something other than football. I'm very curious how, you know, you've been around professional coaches, how they balance that sort of dichotomy, because you know that they're capable of doing it.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the adjustments that they're comfortable with are adjustments that are within their level of their lifetime of experience. Because I find that NFL coaches, even on the field are not that creative or not that adaptive. Like, they understand and kind of have these simple rules that, like, oh, if they're doing this, then we do X. If they're doing Y, we do Z.
Yeah.
And they're just, like, following a formula. It's not actual, like, morphing and adaptation. It's not to the degree that you might see it in the college game, because I think the pressure is so high in NFL locker rooms that no one wants to be the one to try something too radical and then it goes wrong, because then you are marked for your entire career that way. So I think that it's kind of an illusion that they are all that adaptive. And I think that carries over to any other area where you might expect some growth or adaptation. If they really aren't that adaptive. They have one way of thinking about things and one way of doing things. And within that, there's like a small range of adaptation, which isn't actually adaptation. It's just like mimicking whatever they've learned. And,
right.
And I think it appears to be, they appear to be more flexible than they actually are.
I mean, but don't you need to be able to adapt to survive? Is that ever, you think, a concern for football, that if they don't adapt over time, if they don't realize what I want to say the majority of the country is calling for, but if they don't adapt it, then they won't survive? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, but I do think that the game is maybe not adapting, but it is evolving. I think we all appreciate how different it is from like 20 years ago, and even how different it is from 5 years ago. I think the game is evolving, and evolution is a slow process. And I mean, even in biological evolution, not all organisms survive. So football may or may not survive, but I do think it does seem like the forces of the environment are forcing it to evolve to some degree. It may not evolve fast enough, but it seems like it is evolving some.
With regards to Colin Kaepernick, and you've been vocal about it through Twitter, certainly on The Undefeated, and in appearances on the Dan Le Batard Show, you've given your perspective and your take on him already, but I guess when we talk about Colin Kaepernick 20 years from now, what do you think the discussion will be based in?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, this is not novel. I think a lot of people believe that 20 years from now or 30 years from now, we'll look back on Colin Kaepernick and appreciate him for the kind of fearless individual that he is. And I think that right now, all the noise around him, I think will die out. Obviously, it won't be unanimous appreciation, but I think the comparison that people make to Ali, I think it's fairly accurate. Like, obviously Ali was playing or was fighting during a different time, and he had the war and spent time in jail and gave up his belt. Like, those are, I hate to say bigger, but those are like more profound, I guess, sacrifices. But Collins made quite a few sacrifices, and I think with time he'll be looked back upon as like an American hero, frankly. Something that the NFL, I think, it'll be odd, but I think 20, 30 years from now, like, he'll be someone that if the NFL is still around, that they celebrate.
I hope you're right, because I certainly feel that way, and yet there's still a part of me, and maybe it's selfish, that I still want to see him play. I still want to see him play, yeah. Because I think he's perfect. He's certainly talented in today's NFL with the amount of bad, pathetic quarterback play that we've seen this year. Like, the excuses, and I've heard different general managers say, you know, he wasn't a fit for our scheme, or that, you know, we scouted him, we just didn't like what we saw, we felt like we had better options available, and I just don't buy it. Selfishly, I still want to be able to see him play, because I still believe he can play.
Yeah, I still believe he can play also, and I would love to see him play again, but I also kind of enjoy him not playing so that I can point at all these terrible quarterbacks and say, hey, remember Colin Kaepernick? And call out all these coaches who are pretending like it's about something else or it's about on-the-field performance, when obviously it's about their fear for, or maybe it's about them not agreeing with Colin, or what's more likely is it's about their fear of backlash or distraction, which I think is, I don't necessarily believe in the idea of distraction. That's one thing. But I also think that as a head coach, isn't it your job to build a locker room that's strong enough to endure these sorts of things?
I would think so.
That is conducive to bringing in the best talent and whatever culture you created can endure a few extra questions from the media. Like, it just seems absurd to me that it seems like an admission that you're not very good at your job if you don't want to bring Colin Kaepernick in and you don't have a good starting quarterback.
I'm with you. I'm with you as we're talking to Dominique Foxworth here from the Undefeated on the Awful Announcing Podcast, kind enough to give us several minutes of his time today. Is Kaepernick the biggest conversation and back and forth issue that you've been having to not necessarily fight, but try at least inform and discuss on Twitter? I think at one point you had tweeted out an article and I retweeted it, and the three of us, me, you, and some other, you know, yutz on Twitter decided to sort of get involved in a back and forth. Is that sort of the thing that you keep having to try and say, no, he doesn't need to explain himself? That tends to be sort of the ongoing, you know, if you go to the bullet point list of notes from people that don't seem to understand this perspective is, you know, why doesn't he, you know, speak out? You know, why doesn't he go and go to these meetings? And the answer is always, he has. Like, he's made his point very clear. And I guess I'm curious to know as to whether or not is that sort of that single thing that, unfortunately, you get pressed on the most amongst these types of conversations.
Not really, honestly. Like, when something happens and it's back in the news, then yes, I engage in those sort of conversations quite often. I think those tend to be some of the most passionate conversations, I'd say. But it ebbs and flows. Like, I spend a lot of time, I think, kind of trying to educate people about kind of the actual ins and outs of some football situations and football decisions and football plays. And it's not, most of the time, like, surprisingly, I guess contrary to popular belief, most of my, like, social media and Twitter interactions are, like, conversational and kind of kind and enjoyable. Occasionally, they devolve into trash talk, but I try to stay out of that, and unfortunately been able to stay away from it. So, like, I think the Kaepernick stuff comes up and it gets hot and heavy sometimes, but I try not to let anybody get me too riled up.
I want to ask you a little bit about your time at Harvard Business School when you decided to make that choice once you were done playing. That's not always sort of an easy thing to be able to do, just to say, all right, I've played several years in the league. I've already been, you know, representing the NFLPA. Was it more than sort of like, all right, I want to be able to expand my knowledge in an area that I'm already working in? Like, why in particular did you say, this is what I want to do at this very moment?
I decided that I wanted to go to business school. Well, I mean, honestly, after my third season, headed into my fourth season, I got traded from Denver to Atlanta, and it was Matt Ryan's rookie year. I was going to be a free agent after that year. So I just kind of thought that there was a chance that my career would be coming to an end soon, because I didn't know that I would get any going into free agency. Like, I didn't know that I would get a big opportunity at a contract, because I wasn't sure how much I'd be able to play. So that was the first time I started entertaining the idea of going to business school. I played well. It worked out, and my career was extended, and I signed a big contract with Baltimore. But desire to, when I started kind of looking into business schools and then started thinking about my transition to my career afterwards, I got involved in I was involved in FLPA, and we did the CBA negotiations, and it hit me during those negotiations that I was sitting across from the owners, and I was like, hey, these guys aren't smarter than me. And I think prior to sitting there, I would have thought that they became super successful because they were, like, smarter than me. Or super successful in this way because they're smarter than me. And I think probably a lot of people have that. It happens often where you're like, hey, this guy's worth $100 million. He must be really smart. Let's care what he has to say. But right. In actuality, I feel like the range of intelligence is not very different from Joe Blow, whoever your coworker is. It's just that some of these successful people have gotten lucky and they've worked really hard, but it's not because they're actually smarter. So I think having that revelation was like, hey, I could do what they do, not necessarily in the NFL, but in business. And that's when I kind of prior to that, when I was looking at business schools, I was just kind of looking at local small business schools. And then that's when I realized, hey, I could kind of shoot for the top. I could go to the best business school in the country. And that's what really motivated me to do that. And also realizing that career prospects after you leave the NFL are tough to come by, because what you have to put on your resume is like, I'm really good at teamwork, I guess, but like I'm blocking and tackling and throwing and catching. Like, those are not exactly the most marketable skills outside of the NFL. So getting a postgraduate degree really helps.
And what you're doing now at The Undefeated, how often do you use maybe advice from professors or lessons from your time in business school? Are you incorporating more of your time in the NFL, you know, lessons from business school, combinations, discussions at the negotiating table? Yeah. In what you're doing now, how much do you take from every other part of your career that now helps you do what you do at The Undefeated?
Yeah, I think quite a bit. I think the football stuff is obvious, but I think a lot of business school stuff is like, calling it business school, I think, is a bit of a misnomer, because while we do talk about and I learned a lot about like the way to do business, so to speak, business school, I think, is more about redesigning the way you think about problems and the way that you attack problems and incorporating all potential like second and third order outcomes and externalities and putting together a reasonable or an efficient process for making decisions and all that stuff. Like, that is just about changing the way that you think. So I think that there's probably been a lot of formative experiences in my life, but as an adult, I'm not sure that anything's been more formative than the 2 years I spent at business school.
Do you feel like what you're doing and what your colleagues are doing at The Undefeated, do you feel like you guys have gotten not necessarily the support, but the ability to be able to say, like, do you have as much free rein as it feels like you guys do to be able to really be creative? Like, I was going to ask you a little bit later about your love letter series, because I was curious to get your thoughts on Andy Reid, as I'm based out in Kansas City. But in what you're doing now, do you feel like you have as much free rein and creative freedom as maybe you'd like?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you bring up the sort of the practice squad series and the love letter and all the little weird quirky videos that I do. Like, it's hard to say that I don't have free range in creative license when I'm allowed to do weird stuff like that. So yeah, I've been surprised and really satisfied. The best thing I think about being here is like, I'll write about something that's not sports related at all. It's just something about the history of racism in this country. And I'll write an in-depth piece about the complications of Andy Reid's offense. And then I'll do a stupid video where I have on a costume and I'm making fun of something. So, like, I don't know any other media outlets that would allow someone to cover this much ground. So, I mean, I've been extremely satisfied and pleased personally with the amount of autonomy and free range that I've been given.
From the media side, is there anything that you're enjoying more? Is it the writing side? Is it the radio side? Is it the video side? Is there anything in particular that you think, if I had to choose one of these things, this would probably be it?
Yeah, I think what I like about it is that I don't have to choose, honestly, because as much as I think one thing that I want to do more of is probably take on some more ambitious long-term writing assignments, but sometimes writing gets old and tiresome. And the same is true for like being on the radio. Sometimes you're like, well, this is just this doesn't feel like substantial enough. It like feels like too light and fluffy. The same with TV, where so it's nice to be able to go in and out of all those worlds where it's like, all right, I want to do something that's just like just kind of pithy and fun, and I can go on the radio and do that, or I want to do something that's really thoughtful and takes on some of the major issues in our society. I can take a month or so to research and write something about that. I feel really fortunate to be in a position I'm in.
Well, the work has been great, and you can read it over at The Undefeated. You can hear him on ESPN Radio. You follow him on Twitter, at Foxworth24. Last one from me, and again, I really do thank you for your time. It's been great getting a chance to get to know you a little bit and have this conversation. With regards to the love letter series, you wrote one to Andy Reid here in Kansas City, where I'm based. That was after a couple losses, after a great start to the season. They've continued to spiral a little bit. Are you, is he in need of another letter? Do you think they start to turn this around? Is Alex Smith starting to revert back to the man that we used to know and love? I'm curious to get your perspective on whether or not you think this team has any sort of Super Bowl aspirations.
Yeah, I mean, I think they do. My love for Andy Reid goes far beyond just this season. I appreciate that he is one of the more creative minds offensively, and he builds packages of plays that complement each other. So I think when you have Andy Reid as your offensive coordinator, which is what he kind of is, even though he's the head coach, I think you have a chance, despite the fact that they had an ugly loss to the very, very bad New York Giants recently. I still believe in him, but I think what I've been surprised by this year is how bad their defense has been.
Yeah.
Given how much talent they have over there, I know they lost Eric Berry in the first week, but they still have plenty of talent, enough talent to be a middle-of-the-pack defense, and they've been really bad. I think while I believe in Andy, and I think Alex Smith is serviceable, and they have a ton of playmakers on offense, I do think that because of Alex Smith's limitations, that they're never going to be a team that's just going to routinely outscore opponents. And so, I mean, I guess I'm just kind of caping up, defending my boy Andy at this point, but I'm not sure that it's I guess he's the head coach, so it's all on him, but I haven't been all that. I mean, I've been impressed with what he's done offensively this year. I've just been surprised and disappointed with how poorly the defense has played.
Well, the good news is that they have Buffalo coming up on Sunday, and if Sean McDermott decides to start Nathan Peterman again for some God-known reason, Marcus Peters might have five picks by himself in the first half.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I can't figure out. I mean, I don't know. There are no words for what Sean McDermott has done to this season. Like, they just seem like they're confused. Like, they dump all their talent before the season starts, which is like, all right, we're in a rebuild.
Right.
They're going to run Tyrod out of town. Then all of a sudden, they make a trade for Kelvin Benjamin because they're winning some games. They're like, oh, we're going to make a run for it. And then they bench the quarterback that got them this far, which sounds to me like, oh, we got to see what we have in this other guy because we're bailing on the season again. I just don't think that. I don't know. Maybe it's not all McDermott. Maybe it's some front office, but it just doesn't seem like they have a clear, coherent strategy.
No, not at all.
That I learned a lot about in business school.
There you go. You have to have a plan, and you have to execute that plan and know exactly what your plan is to be able to execute it.
You can't change it on a whim just because you all of a sudden won a couple games. Now it's time to go all in. All of a sudden you lose a game here or there. We got to blow up everything and bench our quarterback. This thing's fickle.
We can certainly have this conversation another time. I've taken up more than enough of your time. Dominique Foxworth over from ESPN's The Undefeated and on ESPN Radio, and make sure you follow him as well at Foxworth24. It's been a joy, man. I've really enjoyed an opportunity to talk to you. Thank you for your time. And as someone who discovered you through the great Dan Le Batard show and eventually starting to find out more about your writing and everything that you're doing, I'm really appreciative of your time. And thanks so much for joining us on the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Man, it means a whole lot to hear that promise of you. I do appreciate it, and thanks for having me. I hope we can do this again sometime before the season is over.
My thanks to Dominique Foxworth for his time and joining us on the podcast today. Also, a special thank you to all of our roundtable members, Ken Fang, Andrew Buchholz, and Joe Lucia. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks for the next edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Be sure to stay tuned on Twitter and get an opportunity to play in our Clip It game. All you have to do is guess who the next feature guest is going to be, and you have an opportunity to win up to $50. At Amazon.com. Until then, it's Ben Heisler saying thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.